Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Are you?
I am indeed. We've had much better weather here. Cooling today, though, where I think it may have gone down into the 50s overnight. And I haven't checked the weather, but maybe that corresponds to some cold wave they're having in the north of me.
Rick, also a chill sent over the banking sector with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in New York. The small to moderate banks asked for fewer regulations. They got it. And is this the result?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. You know, David Stockman pointed out the irony of the fact that none other than Barney Frank sits on the board of Signature. And he's Mr. Dodd-Frank personified. And I guess when they put him on the board, it was with the drum roll about how they were getting a genius with decades of experience and whatever Barney Frank had experience in. But it certainly wasn't banking, or not in some way that would have saved Signature. So it's sort of funny that Signature has gone down with under the nose of their board member Barney Frank. So and it won't be the last of it, really. You know, when you look at how this weekend very quiet bailout occurred, it was effectively $9 trillion in guarantees of money that's obviously not there. Nobody has that money. But of course, when the government steps in and says, hey, everything's cool, everybody kind of believes that, except me and perhaps my subscribers.
Well, as we know, money really isn't printed anymore. They just punch a couple of letters and numbers on a keyboard, and there you go. Here's your $1 million mortgage.
Well, they actually saved the key punch operator some work in this instance, because they didn't print anything. They just stepped up and said, hey, look, hey, we're good for it, you know. It's okay. So it didn't involve any printing. It's almost easier to manufacture that $9 trillion guarantee than it is to take Apple and sell it to exhaustion overnight so they can short squeeze it during the day. I've written about that recently, because when you get a 3, 4, or 5 point gap in Apple on the opening, you're effectively putting as much as $50 to $100 billion into the economy. That's what happens when you take a $2.5 trillion company and you run it up 3 or 4 points on effectively zero volume. That's what a gap is. There's no stock trading in that gap, and yet the stock is appreciating in value. And, of course, with respect to the wealth effect, that money is instantly spendable.
Are we going to see more small and medium-sized banks fail? And are the big banks in the U.S. still in danger?
Everything's in danger. The whole cockamamie banking system is just, if anybody took a close look, they're in way over their heads. And I mean way over where they were thought to be over their heads with the so-called loans to the SNL crisis that got punched up because of loans to third world countries and everybody else. We thought those were big numbers then, but they were less than $1 trillion, much less. And I think we don't want to look too closely at the banking system.
Were the collapses due to the move by governments towards digital currency?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of wishful conspiracy thinking there, you know, that, well, they, with a capital T, are going to use some banking crisis to implement a digital money system. And that's really stupid thinking, because the crisis itself would create a condition of a lack of confidence in the banking system that would make the implementation of a digital money system impossible. If you try to logically think your way through it, how would that be done? Well, because forget about a run on the banks. You know, the first three people who line up at various banks in various cities are going to be, they're going to find out that the branches only have maybe $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on hand. So we're not going to have a run on cash. And so the banks would close for, let's say, 2, 3, 4 days, however long it takes to implement the digital system. And it would have to take the form of zeros being added to your bank account. And I think initially they, with a capital T, would say, whatever you had in your account, trust us, it's still there. And you got to focus on that trust us part of the, that sentence. You know, nobody will trust anybody at that point. And even though the government will have told you that that money is still there, and if they wanted to hyperinflate, they could, if things got really bad and it looked like there was a collapse, even, you know, like a second stage collapse, then they might say, hey, we've just added a zero to your bank account. And at that point, we get on a hyperinflationary track, which, as I've said over many, many years, I don't think it could possibly happen. I won't say it's impossible, but I would say there's only a 1% possibility that all the debts that we piled up will somehow be discharged in a hyperinflation, leaving all the creditors out to sea. You know, they'll be the big losers. I don't think so. So anyway, about this digital money system, we already have a digital money system. It's called credit cards. You know, nobody uses cash for big transactions. It's just groceries. So the digital money system is just fine, and it's doing a much better job than Bitcoin or any of the cryptos ever did, which is, you know, it's obvious that nobody uses cryptos to buy stuff. They just use it to speculate. And it recalls the joke about the punchline of which is, oh, those aren't eating sardines, those are trading sardines. So that's what Bitcoin is. It's a lot of trading sardines. And I don't say that Bitcoin is without value, but I think $3 or $4 would do it, not $70,000. And I give it $3 or $4 worth of valuation simply because the blockchain idea is pretty good. It's a very useful way to record transactions in a more or less secure way. So it does have value for transactions, which, as I just mentioned, it's never used for transactions. But just to give Bitcoin some hypothetical value, I'd set it at around $3 or $4 rather than a current, where are we trading today, 24,883 as I speak. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm not gung-ho on you don't actually bury your Bitcoin in the backyard like you do with gold, but you have it salted away somewhere.
Now, countries like Canada and the UK years ago sold off all their gold at bargain basement prices. Does the U.S. have any gold to back up its currency, or is Fort Knox just an empty structure with a lot of guns around it?
Well, that's a fun story, really. I don't know. I mean, who knows what the actual gold holdings of the U.S. are. And it's not as though merely holding them predisposes them toward having honest money if we emerge from some crisis. You know, it's the last thing, the most deflationary thing you could have is money tied to gold, honest money. And you can imagine how sales of things like crude oil would drop, people, if we had to pay for them in gold. You know, we talk about it. It's convenient to pay for them in dollars because dollars have been infinitely available. And, you know, the oil producers sort of get into the game, into the charade. They just raise prices. That's all to at least partly offset the inflation of a financialized world. So there are countries, though, that hold gold in the way that a lot of my subscribers do, you know, just for that rainy day. They don't have this greedy idea that they're going to make their fortune in gold, but it's just a good thing to keep around because it's very likely to hold its purchasing power relative to any other asset you can name. So countries like China, for one, has encouraged its citizens to buy and hold gold, and I think there's a sufficient reverence for gold among the Chinese that the government doesn't have to have an official policy or a huge inventory of Fort Knox of its own. It doesn't need it as long as its people are saving at least some of their money in gold. And Russia, I think, probably has, let's more explicitly, geopolitical designs in whatever gold it holds. But to speak of Russia to personify it, it's no fool as far as gold and its perception of the Western money system is somewhat compromised.
I think the attitude with the Canadian government as well, Canada, the country itself has gold deposits, so we'll just go out and mine some if we need it.
Well, Canada, for all the foolishness of of its leaders, it does possess the resources that gold would command in some sort of crisis. And no one should think that if they've got a safe deposit box filled with Krugerrands, that those Krugerrands are necessarily going to buy a whole lot. I always tell my subscribers that if their hearts are set on keeping gold until it hits 50,000, they better find themselves one dumb farmer to buy something, to buy farmland, which of course produces things that people can eat. But the gold itself, you can't eat it, and there may come a day, I hope it never comes, but there may come a day when the bread truck arrives, the government's bread truck, and you need to pay, you offer a Krugerrand in exchange for a loaf of bread, and the guy says, well, I can't eat that Krugerrand. It'll be two Krugerrands for the loaf today. So, gold is lacking the fungibility of some of the things. I won't put it in terms of fungibility because there'll always be someone willing to exchange good things for gold. But in the case of Canada, you've got all the natural resources to stay alive.
Of course, we have a government that refuses to use them.
And yeah, but it's nice to have. I mean, you guys are pretty self-sufficient. When you measure Canada's resources, its agricultural productivity and energy resources, mineral resources, against your relatively sparse population, you've got plenty to go around.
That's true. Canada's got five big cities, six. That's it.
That's right.
And lots of room in between them. We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, what do you think is going to happen with oil, which has dropped dramatically?
Yeah, I don't follow the story because I can never really understand why crude does what it does. But I can certainly chart it. And yesterday's low could have been an important low. It did connect up with the target I had for a bearish pattern. But there's a problem, really, with crude coming down the way it has. You might think, well, it's going to show up as lower prices at the gas pump, and isn't that great for everybody? And it will lower production costs for all industry manufacturing that is energy intensive. But that's sort of a long way off. It's the question is, can you wait? And the financial problems that attend collapse in oil prices are much more significant than the somewhere down the road benefits of lower energy prices, mainly because when we came out of the housing collapse of 2007 and 8, the smart guys looked around and thought, well, what the hell can we hock up to our eyeballs to get rich again without doing any work, just shuffling a lot of paper? And the obvious answer was the energy patch. So a lot of the collateral that went into the inflation that we've experienced in assets since recovering from the 2007-08 collapse has come from energy loans against energy productivity. So the world sort of needs higher energy prices, higher oil prices, let's say, and natural gas than it does lower prices at the pump. And so the whole shaky financial edifice, and I'm talking about a good piece of the $2+ quadrillion derivatives market, is not benefiting from this very steep downtrend in crude. And if it keeps going, you're going to be reading about it as a reading about what a problem it is in the same way I'm describing to you now.
Is one of the problems with crude, governments have stopped subsidizing the search for oil and new oil rigs, and oil companies don't want to spend their own money, and they've realized, like they did last year, the less we produce, the more money we make.
Well, it would be great if that's all we were doing. We were stopping the subsidies of oil, but the Interior Secretary is so zealously carrying out Biden's policy of let's do away with all the energy productivity now, and we'll somehow produce alternatives later on. So it's not a question of just the subsidies are not being made any longer. The exploration is being actively thwarted, discouraged, whatever.
Well, yes. Now people want to transition, I guess, into electric vehicles, alternative energy, but there doesn't seem to be any bridging strategy to help that out. And the government's only strategy here in Canada is to add more carbon taxes at the gasoline pump.
Right, and we all know that every penny of those taxes is being spent on a brighter future. You know, it wouldn't be misdirected, redirected into other areas such as, well, in the U.S. even, you'd think it'd be paying Social Security checks or something like that. Mm. So I think that's probably, well, the main objection to energy taxes. We all have to doubt that they're being productively deployed. The government doesn't deploy any tax money in an efficient, effective, productive, growth-oriented way.
I think in Norway, they put their oil royalties into their pension plan. And so people there actually have, per person, millions of dollars. At least years ago, it was $1 million a person, and it's probably more than that now because they know oil is going to run out at some point.
Well, they should ask the Native Americans in Alaska, how's that working for you, you know? It's nice that we've got this hypothetical figure of everybody's divvying up the energy resources of Norway. And I don't doubt that Norway's used the proceeds from the sale of crude oil in a way that will benefit them over the long run. I give them the benefit of the doubt for having more foresight and integrity than their counterparts in the U.S.
Wow. I just went to Norwegian Oil Fund, and they have a tracker here showing you how much it's growing in value by every second. Boy, I don't know what kroner are worth, but they've got a lot of them in there.
So with oils, with the fall of crude from, $80 down to 60, recent 66, that number, number that the Norwegians checked before they even had their coffee in the morning has probably come down a little bit.
Well, 14 billion something.
And 14, I'm sorry, did you say zillion?
14 billion.
Oh, okay.
And there's what, 3 to 5 million? I'm not sure of the exact population of Norway, but I'd say 3 to 5 million, about the same as the population of British Columbia.
Well, someone's got to go over there and sell them some term insurance or something. With all that money, they should be sitting ducks for the sales force of the world.
Let's see. Well, 5.45 million persons. Oh, I wasn't far off. So, Rick, what's going to go on with real estate in this kind of atmosphere? Are mortgages guaranteed? If the bank goes under, do you lose your house? I don't know how that works.
I'm glad you asked. The good news in a real crisis is that we're not going to lose our homes because the lenders who technically own those homes, they're not going to want to put everyone, and I mean everyone, out on the streets. So we'll keep our houses, but we're having a silent crash right now in real estate. This is something we talked about 6 months ago, but the dynamic is probably intensified somewhat. You have a situation really where there are X number of baby boomers who would love to downsize. And they're sitting in homes that are overvalued by, who knows, 80% relative to, it's hard to say what those homes would be worth if we didn't have, 3% mortgages for all those years. So they'd love to get rid of them, but there are no buyers, certainly no buyers with mortgages up at 7%. And, the homeowners are just sort of sitting tight and thinking, well, I don't have to sell this place. I can just keep living in it. So what will happen eventually is that the bids will fall away. There will be no bids, and there won't be any qualified buyers either. So the homes are all going to revert to the children. They're going to be passed down from the baby boomers estate to their children and grandchildren, who won't be able to pay the taxes on them, which will destroy the local tax base of all the cities in America. They're collecting taxes on homes in some boondock subdivision. You can't find a state that's boondocky enough that it doesn't have a whole bunch of $600,000 homes. So when those homes seek out their proper value, maybe $100,000, the tax revenues that come to the local jurisdictions are going to vanish. So that's a big problem down the road. But more immediately, we have the problem of the big guys getting into spec house home rentals in a big way. And they are, I think, more than 10% of the market right now. More than 10% of our homes are owned by speculators trying to rent them. All right. Now, for starters, if you're renting out a home, the question is to whom? Well, to someone who can't afford a home, to buy a home. So all these rentals are being done to ostensibly less than stellar credit risks. But if you let's take a specific place. Let's go to Las Vegas, all right? Now, Zillow owns, I think it's 4,000 homes in Las Vegas. And of those 4,000, about 400 are vacant. And you can imagine that the 10% is certainly enough vacancies to throw off their entire model, to make what looked like a profitable idea going in unprofitable. And the real problem is that they can't lower the rents to fill those vacant homes, because if they do, it will it will push the value of all 4,000 homes that they own downward. It'll put pressure on them because if the, you know, if you're calculating the value of a home based on what it could produce in rental income, if rentals are soft, then the prices are going to come down. So, and once that happens, it's very hard to lift them up again because you need another crazy boom to do that. I think we've run out of crazy booms. All right, so instead of lowering the rent for their 4,000 homes, they're offering incentives for people to come in. You know, you rent now, we'll give you the first 2 months free. So that's sort of masking the weakness in the housing market there, and masking what would otherwise be the beginning of a collapse in real estate places in Las Vegas. And I don't mean to imply that this is it's just Las Vegas. This is all over the country where these same deals play out. All right. It also doesn't help that the homes were acquired at the top of the market. And not only that, but in order to whip them into shape quickly to rent them out, the spec buyers, Zillow and BlackRock and all those, they paid top dollar. So why did they do that? Well, their bean counters said, look, you know, who cares what we pay for these homes or what we pay to fix them up? Just look at this one, a 10-year accrual. Everything looks great 10 years out. So that's what they're stuck with now. Their numbers are not panning out. And of course, it's the same way that, you know, an 8% factoring 8% growth for all the investments, the pension fund investments. It's the same fallacy, really. They're taking a straight line extrapolation, saying things are great now and they'll never be less than great. But it's telling you something when the assumptions of the actuaries that that essentially gin up numbers for the pension funds are probably higher than what Warren Buffett has taken out of the markets in the last 10 years. So so that's the problem in real estate.
Do all these people in the stock markets, financial scene, pay way too much attention to the Federal Reserve?
Well, it's all they care about. It's not too much attention. It's the only thing they pay attention to. And we've reached a point, really, where all news, unless it's really a bombshell, like what's-his-face, Powell's last announcement about, no, not only are we not pivoting, but we're going to kind of accelerate the tightening. All right, so that did catch the market by surprise. But virtually any other news is used to jack stocks. You know, we saw it today. I think the unemployment is unemployment claims were down or something like that. And whatever way the market zigs or zags in the first few seconds, it doesn't matter. You'll see that virtually every news, it just the mere element of surprise in it, or what little surprise there is exploited as a short squeeze opportunity. So everything we read about connected to the economy, it has no significance other than what all the idiots out there think it will mean to the Fed. You know, well, payroll is jobs are down, unemployment claims are up, down, whatever. The first instinct is, well, how will the Fed interpret this? And whatever the answer is, I just mentioned, the surprise of it is used to ambush shorts. You don't ambush longs. You can have what's called a long squeeze, but it's not something we've seen in a long, 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 very long time. But the short squeeze is it's the easiest goosing. It's the easiest way to jack the markets, to manipulate them, meaning it'll always be higher. And as if the initial faint is lower, you got to buy it because there's a mission out there to keep the stock market, to keep stock prices up.
Some analysts have suggested the market's had a great climb, but if there's a further decline, it's going to be the anti-slope. I don't know the exact term for it, but if it climbed 40%, it's going to drop 40%.
We wish. You know, to think that it's just going to return to some semblance of normal in terms of earnings multiples or whatever, that's wishful thinking. You know, you're always going to, you're going to overshoot to the extreme. We're not coming back to the mean average line. We're going to overshoot what might be seen now, imagined as the lower threshold of rationality. So don't, I wouldn't put too much hope in a mere 40% correction of perceived excesses to the upside of 40%.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I'd say avert your eyes from newspapers, from headlines and all that. But I don't know. It's the business with the banks. What's more unsettling than the fact that the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history both went down over the same weekend? Well, more unsettling than that is what is passing for a remedy. You know, the blather that went out to calm the herd is so lacking in substance and persuasiveness. You gotta be crazy to think that we've seen the worst of it.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Oh, always a pleasure, Jim. I don't mean to darken your day. Maybe we could talk about a sunnier topic next time. But anyway, thanks for inviting me on.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.